A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's looking at the weird bifurcation in higher education. The one where we call some training vocational and some academic. An electrician goes to a technical institute. A product manager goes to university and maybe studies something completely unrelated to their eventual job. And a doctor goes to university because the licensing system demands it. But here's the thing. All of these are training for a vocation. So how did we decide some kinds of work get the university seal of approval and others get shunted into what we treat as the minor leagues? And he's asking us to take the long historical view. How did training for different fields get tiered and orchestrated over centuries?
This is one of those questions where the answer is basically 800 years of accumulated historical accidents that we've retroactively decided was a plan. And the place to start is with something that'll sound counterintuitive. The very first universities were vocational schools.
Of course they were.
The University of Bologna, founded in 1088, widely considered the oldest university in continuous operation. It was essentially a trade school for lawyers. Students paid professors directly to teach them Roman law, specifically the rediscovered Digest of Justinian, because there was this enormous demand for legally trained administrators in the Holy Roman Empire and the Italian city-states. You went to Bologna to get a job. It was vocational training.
The original university was a coding boot camp for 12th century lawyers. And I mean that literally, right? You show up, you pay your money, you learn a specific technical skill that's in high demand, and you walk into a job. The only difference is the tech stack was Justinian rather than JavaScript.
Not entirely inaccurate. And the same pattern holds for the other medieval professions. Medicine at Salerno and Montpellier, theology at Paris and Oxford, these were explicitly training clergy, physicians, and jurists. The bachelor's degree, the master's degree, the doctorate. These were guild structures. You entered as an apprentice, became a journeyman, produced a masterpiece, and were admitted to the Guild of Masters. The terminology is literally guild terminology.
Wait, so the academic regalia, the gowns and hoods and all that?
Medieval guild uniforms. The academic procession is a guild procession. When someone receives a doctorate today and wears that floppy hat, they're cosplaying as a 13th century master craftsman being admitted to the guild. The entire apparatus of modern higher education is a medieval trade guild that somehow convinced everyone it was something else entirely.
Like a historical version of a restaurant that started as a food truck and now insists on a dress code.
And meanwhile, actual trade guilds were running a parallel system. From about the 12th century onward, if you wanted to be a stonemason or a goldsmith or a wheelwright, you entered a formal apprenticeship, typically 5 to 7 years, living in the master's household, learning the craft, eventually producing a masterpiece of your own and being admitted to the guild. This system produced the cathedrals, the bridges, the armor, the furniture of medieval Europe. It was rigorous, it was regulated, and it had enormous social prestige. If you were a master stonemason in 13th century Chartres, you were not a low-status person. You were a highly respected craftsman whose work would stand for centuries.
At this point in history, the lawyer trained at Bologna and the stonemason trained in the guild are both in apprenticeship systems, both regulated, both producing a tangible qualification. There's no hierarchy yet.
Not in the way we'd recognize. The hierarchy starts to emerge in the early modern period, but the real inflection point, and this is where the story gets interesting, is 1810. Wilhelm von Humboldt founds the University of Berlin.
Humboldt is the guy who invented the idea that a university isn't about job training.
Humboldt introduced this concept called Bildung. It's usually translated as education or self-cultivation, but it's more than that. It's the idea that education should develop the whole person. That knowledge is pursued for its own sake, that research and teaching must be united, and that the state should fund this without demanding immediate practical returns. The Humboldtian University was explicitly designed to be above vocational concerns. Pure knowledge, pure research, pure inquiry, applied training was for lesser institutions.
This is where the split becomes ideological. But I want to pause on this, because Humboldt wasn't just some abstract philosopher. He was a Prussian civil servant designing an actual system. What problem was he trying to solve?
He was trying to create a class of administrators and thinkers who could serve the Prussian state without being narrowly trained technocrats. The idea was that someone who had studied philosophy and classics and mathematics would be a better civil servant than someone who had just learned administrative procedures, because they would have judgment, breadth, the ability to think across domains. And there's a genuine insight there. General education does produce different kinds of thinkers than narrow technical training. The problem is that Humboldt then turned that insight into a hierarchy, and the hierarchy got welded onto the class structure. It spread like wildfire. The German model influenced Johns Hopkins when it was founded in 1876 as the first American research university. It shaped the red brick universities in the UK. And it shaped the Irish system. The Queen's Colleges established in 1845 in Cork, Galway, and Belfast were modeled on this ideal, and the National University of Ireland, founded in 1908, embedded it further. The idea that a real university does pure knowledge and anything practical is a step down.
Here's what I find interesting. This Humboldtian ideal lands in the 19th century, at exactly the moment when class stratification is hardening across Europe. So you've got this philosophical justification for separating pure from applied knowledge, arriving right when the upper classes need a way to distinguish their sons' education from the tradesmen's.
That's not a coincidence. The class dimension is explicit in the legislation. The UK's Technical Instruction Act of 1889 created a separate system of technical education that was, and I'm quoting the language of the time, designed for the industrial classes. Not a subtle document. In Ireland, the Vocational Education Act of 1926 established a parallel system of vocational schools that were legally barred from offering academic courses until the 1960s. They weren't allowed to cross the line. If you were the child of a farmer or a factory worker, you were routed into the vocational track, and the law made sure you stayed there.
By the early 20th century, we've got a legally enforced caste system dressed up as educational philosophy. The university is for gentlemen who study pure knowledge and become clergymen or civil servants or doctors. The technical school is for the working class who learn a trade and stay in their lane. And we've convinced ourselves this is natural.
What's remarkable is how durable that framing has been even after the legal barriers came down. Ireland removed the legal restrictions in the 1960s, but the status hierarchy persisted. The binary system, universities on one side, regional technical colleges, and later institutes of technology on the other, remained the organizing principle of Irish higher education until very recently. You could take identical engineering content at an institute of technology and at a university, and the university version was treated as inherently superior.
Because the prestige isn't in the curriculum, it's in the institution's historical position in the class hierarchy. The content is almost incidental.
This is where the 2018 merger comes in, right? Dublin Institute of Technology, Institute of Technology Tallaght, and Institute of Technology Blanchardstown all merged to become Technological University Dublin.
TU Dublin, yes. And this was supposed to erase the binary divide. The whole point of the technological university model was to say, these institutions do research. They grant doctorates. They're universities. The distinction is obsolete. And yet, if you talk to anyone in the Irish system, the status hierarchies are alive and well. Employers still sort CVs by whether the degree says university or technological university. Parents still steer their kids toward the traditional universities. The branding changed faster than the culture.
Because you can't legislate prestige out of existence. The whole point of a status hierarchy is that it persists beyond any rational justification for it. There's a wonderful case study in this. When the UK Polytechnics were granted university status in 1992, the exact same thing happened. Overnight, 35 polytechnics became universities. And what happened? Employers simply recalibrated. They started distinguishing between old universities and new universities. the hierarchy didn't disappear. It just found a new axis to operate on.
The prestige gradient is like water. You can change the containers, but it finds its own level. And this is where we should talk about what actually happened to the credential landscape in the 20th century, because the Humboldtian ideal collided with mass higher education and produced something genuinely irrational.
The credential inflation spiral.
After World War II, you see this massive expansion of university access across the developed world. The GI Bill in the US, the Robbins Report in the UK in 1963, the introduction of free secondary and then tertiary education in Ireland. And the logic was egalitarian. Open the universities to everyone, break the class barrier. But what actually happened was that as more people got degrees, employers started using the degree as a screening device for jobs that had never required one.
This is the part where the spiral becomes self-reinforcing in a way that's hard to escape. Let me give you a concrete example. In the 1960s, you could get an entry-level job at a bank with a secondary school certificate and work your way up to branch manager over a career. By the 1990s, that same entry-level bank job required a university degree. Any degree, the subject didn't matter. The job itself hadn't changed substantially. What changed was the number of graduates in the labor pool, which meant employers could use the degree as a filter without having to think about what they were actually filtering for.
The degree becomes the new high school diploma. It doesn't necessarily signal that you learned anything relevant to the job. It signals that you're the kind of person who can complete a degree. It's a class marker and a persistence marker rolled into one.
This hits the vocational sector from the other direction. At the same time that university degrees are inflating, you see what's called licensing creep in the trades. Occupations that were historically learned on the job, electricians, plumbers, HVAC technicians, even funeral directors, barbers, and interior designers in some states, become subject to formal licensing requirements, mandatory coursework, continuing education credits. So the vocational path, which was supposed to be the practical, accessible alternative, becomes more regulated and more expensive to enter.
Meanwhile, the university graduate who studied medieval French poetry walks into a product manager role at a tech company with no licensing exam, no regulated training, no formal qualification in product management whatsoever. The system is perfectly upside down.
It's not just upside down, it's self-perpetuating. Because once a critical mass of people in a field have degrees, the employers who don't require degrees start to look like they're scraping the bottom of the barrel. And the universities have every incentive to keep the spiral going because they're the ones selling the credentials. It's a very comfortable arrangement for the institutions at the top of the prestige hierarchy.
There's a fascinating psychological dimension to this. Once you've spent 4 years and a significant amount of money getting a degree, you have a vested interest in believing that degree was necessary. So the people doing the hiring are often degree holders themselves, and they're not exactly motivated to conclude that their own credential was optional.
That's the self-justification loop. And it means the spiral has both structural drivers and psychological drivers reinforcing each other, which makes it extraordinarily difficult to interrupt.
That's the world we built. But here's where the counterexamples get interesting, because not every country went down this path. Germany looked at the same historical forces and made different choices.
The German dual system is the gold standard for vocational education, and it's worth understanding why it works. About 50% of German school leavers enter an apprenticeship program rather than a university. These aren't dropouts or low performers. The system attracts top students across hundreds of occupations. You spend part of your week in a vocational school learning theory and part of your week at a company doing actual work. The employer pays you a training allowance. The curriculum is designed jointly by industry associations, unions, and the government. And when you finish, you have a recognized qualification that employers actually value.
The stigma that attaches to vocational education in Ireland or the UK or the US, it doesn't exist in Germany in the same way.
It doesn't. A Meister qualification in Germany carries social prestige. You can go from an apprenticeship to a Meister, to running your own business, to a university degree later if you want. The pathways are porous, and the economic outcomes bear this out. OECD data from 2023 shows Germany's youth unemployment rate at 5.8% versus Ireland's 9.2%. Germany's tertiary attainment rate for 25 to 34-year-olds is 48.6% versus Ireland's 56.7%. So fewer Germans go to university, but more of them are employed in jobs that match their skills.
The Irish system is producing more graduates and worse outcomes. That's the credential inflation spiral in one statistic. But how does the German system actually maintain employer buy-in? Because that seems like the fragile part. If employers decide they'd rather just hire graduates and let someone else pay for the training, the whole thing collapses.
The key is that German employers have genuine co-ownership of the system. They're not just consumers of trained workers, they're co-producers. Chambers of commerce and industry associations are legally responsible for certifying training firms, developing curricula, and administering exams. Employers invest in apprentices because they get productive workers during the training period, and they get first pick of the graduates. It's not charity, it's a rational economic calculation. But it requires a level of coordination between industry, government, and education that most countries have never attempted.
It requires employers to think in terms of multi-year investments rather than quarterly hiring needs, which is not exactly the Anglo-American corporate instinct.
The UK data is even more stark. A 2023 report found that about 30% of UK graduates are in jobs classified as non-graduate roles, meaning jobs that don't require a degree. Meanwhile, skilled trades are facing chronic labor shortages. Electricians, plumbers, welders, carpenters. These are in high demand, they pay well, and they can't be automated easily. But the cultural machinery keeps steering 18-year-olds toward university degrees they may not need for jobs that may not exist.
Let me push on something here. The system is clearly irrational from an economic standpoint. It misallocates talent. It produces skills mismatches. It loads young people with debt for credentials that don't pay off. But if it's so irrational, why does it persist? What's the hidden function?
I think there are at least two hidden functions. The first is class reproduction. The university system, for all its rhetoric about social mobility, is extraordinarily effective at converting parental privilege into children's credentials. The elite universities take in disproportionately wealthy students and confer degrees that act as class markers. Employers use those class markers as hiring signals. The vocational track, by contrast, has historically been where you send working-class children. The bifurcation maintains the class structure while allowing everyone to claim the system is meritocratic.
The second function?
The second is that it lets the state off the hook for workforce planning. If you have a genuine national training system that matches skills supply to labor demand, the government has to actually coordinate with industry, project future needs, and make hard decisions about funding allocation. If instead you just expand university places and let the market sort it out, you can announce that you've increased higher education participation and call it a day. The mismatch costs are borne by graduates who can't find appropriate work and employers who can't find skilled workers, but those costs are diffuse and delayed. The political benefit of announcing more university places is immediate.
The irrational system is perfectly rational for the people who run it.
This is where I want to complicate the story a bit, because it's not just about status and politics. There's a genuine intellectual tension here that the Humboldtians were responding to, even if they framed it in class terms. Some kinds of knowledge really are different from others. Learning to wire a building is not the same kind of learning as interpreting a legal text or designing a clinical trial. The question isn't whether there are differences. It's whether those differences map onto the institutional hierarchy we've built.
The problem isn't that we distinguish between types of training. It's that we've attached a prestige gradient to that distinction, and then used it to sort people by class background. But let me push on the other side of this. Is there a version of the argument where some kinds of knowledge do require a different institutional structure? Like, if you're training a surgeon, you need teaching hospitals and cadavers and a long supervised practice period. If you're training a historian, you need libraries and archives and a different kind of mentorship. Maybe the institutional separation isn't entirely arbitrary.
That's a fair push. And I think the answer is that different kinds of training do need different structures. But the structures we've built map onto the actual differences very poorly. A surgeon and a welder both need supervised practice on real materials with real consequences for failure. A historian and a software engineer both need to learn how to work with complex abstract systems and incomplete information. The natural clusters don't line up with the university versus vocational divide. We've imposed a binary on a spectrum.
The prestige gradient maps poorly onto actual complexity. Being an electrician involves understanding electrical theory, building codes, safety protocols, and diagnostic reasoning. Being a plumber requires knowledge of fluid dynamics, material science, and local regulations. These are cognitively demanding fields. The idea that they're for less academic students is just empirically false.
Yet that idea gets reinforced from an early age. There's a well-documented phenomenon where secondary school students who struggle with academic subjects are steered toward vocational tracks, not because the vocational tracks are less demanding, but because we've decided that's where the non-academic students go. Then we're surprised when those students struggle with the theoretical components of their trade training, because it turns out electrical theory is actually quite difficult and requires the same kind of abstract reasoning we were supposedly filtering for.
The electrician diagnosing a fault in a complex building's wiring is doing intellectual work. The product manager running a stand-up meeting about sprint velocity is also doing intellectual work. But we've decided one of them needed a 3-year degree in a lesser institution, and the other needed a 4-year degree in a real university. And neither of those decisions was made on educational grounds.
Which brings us to what we can actually do about this. Because it's easy to diagnose the problem, the harder question is what a better system looks like. And I think there are 3 reforms that would actually move the needle.
I'm listening.
First, fund vocational and academic pathways equally per student. Right now, in most countries, university students get significantly more public funding per head than vocational students. In Ireland, the funding gap between universities and institutes of technology was a political issue for decades. The institutes consistently received less per student despite serving more disadvantaged populations. Equalizing funding isn't just about fairness, it's about signaling. When the state spends less on vocational education, it's telling everyone that vocational education matters less.
The signal gets internalized. Students pick up on it. Parents pick up on it. Employers pick up on it. You can't tell someone that a pathway is equally valid while spending 30% less on it. The numbers contradict the rhetoric.
Second, create genuine transfer pathways between systems. The German model works partly because someone who does an apprenticeship can later enter a university program and have their prior learning recognized. In many countries, if you start in the vocational track, you're essentially locked in. There's no bridge back to the academic track, or if there is, it's so cumbersome that almost nobody uses it. That has to change. And third, and this is the one that's hardest politically, incentivize employer involvement in curriculum design. The reason the German dual system produces good skills matching is that employers are at the table designing what gets taught. When vocational education is run entirely by educational institutions with no industry input, you get curricula that are 5 years out of date and graduates who need retraining on day one.
The third one is interesting because it applies to universities too. The reason so many graduates end up in jobs unrelated to their degrees is that nobody asked employers what they actually needed while the curriculum was being designed. The Humboldtian ideal actively discourages that question. It's supposed to be about pure knowledge, not employer demand.
That's the core tension we haven't resolved. The Humboldtian model says education is about developing the whole person, not about job training. The credential inflation spiral says degrees are job training whether we admit it or not. And the vocational track is caught in the middle, stigmatized for being just job training in a system where everyone is ultimately seeking job training.
For a listener who's trying to navigate this, maybe they're a parent, maybe they're a young person making decisions, maybe they're an employer trying to hire, what's the practical takeaway?
Change the question you ask. Instead of asking, what degree should I get, or what university should I attend, ask, what do I want to be able to do? The degree question is a relic of the bifurcation. It assumes the answer is a credential from a particular type of institution. The capability question opens up the full range of pathways. Maybe the answer is a university degree. Maybe it's an apprenticeship. Maybe it's a coding boot camp. Maybe it's starting a business and learning on the job. The point is to evaluate the pathway by outcomes, not by prestige.
For employers, maybe stop using the degree as a proxy for ability. If you're hiring for a role that doesn't require a degree, and many don't, then requiring one is just lazy filtering that screens out capable people who took a different path.
Tech companies have been dropping degree requirements for years. Google, Apple, IBM, They've all said publicly that a 4-year degree is not required for many technical roles. Boot camps and micro-credentials and apprenticeship-style programs are proliferating. In some ways, the tech industry is reinventing the guild model, project-based portfolios, demonstrated competence, mentorship from experienced practitioners.
Which is exactly where we started. The medieval guild system, the original university at Bologna, the apprenticeship model that built the cathedrals. It was all about demonstrated competence and progression through mastery. We spent 500 years building an elaborate prestige hierarchy on top of that, and now the market is slowly dismantling it.
The question that leaves us with, and this is where I think the next decade gets really interesting, is what happens when AI automates both routine cognitive work and routine manual work simultaneously? If the academic vocational distinction was built on the idea that some work is intellectual and some is manual, what happens when machines can do both?
That's the collapse scenario. The distinction stops being merely arbitrary and becomes actively meaningless. If an AI can draft a legal brief and a robot can wire a building, then the prestige gradient between the lawyer and the electrician is exposed as pure social construction with no underlying reality.
You could argue we're already seeing the early signs. The learn-to-code advice that was everywhere a decade ago, that was essentially saying, acquire a vocational skill that happens to be cognitively demanding. Nobody called coding boot camps vocational education, but that's exactly what they are. And nobody looks down on a software engineer the way they might look down on an electrician, even though both are people who learned a practical skill and apply it to solve problems.
The distinction was always about class, not about content. Coding got a pass because it's associated with high salaries and startup culture and hoodies, as business attire. Plumbing didn't get a pass because it's associated with, well, actual work. And I wonder if that's the simplest diagnostic for whether a field has escaped the vocational stigma. Does it involve getting your hands dirty in a way that's visible?
That's a sharp observation. The cognitive versus manual distinction maps almost perfectly onto the clean versus dirty distinction, which in turn maps onto class. The lawyer works in a clean office in a suit. The electrician works in a construction site covered in dust. The status hierarchy is partly an aesthetic judgment about what kind of work looks dignified from the outside.
To be fair, there's a gender dimension here too. The fields that got shunted into the vocational track, construction, manufacturing, automotive repair, are overwhelmingly male. The fields that got elevated to university status, and I'm thinking of nursing and teaching here, which were vocational until relatively recently. Those became more female-dominated as they moved up the prestige ladder. The hierarchy isn't just about class. It's about which bodies are doing which work.
That's the part of this story that often gets left out. Nursing is a perfect case study. For most of the 20th century, nursing was hospital-based training, essentially an apprenticeship model. You learned by doing, under supervision, in a teaching hospital. Then, starting in the 1960s and accelerating through the 1990s, nursing moved into the university system. And as it moved, it gained prestige and became more female-dominated than it already was. The content of the training didn't change as much as the institutional wrapper did.
We've got class, gender, and institutional inertia all reinforcing a system that doesn't actually serve anyone well except the people at the top of the prestige pyramid. And the people at the top have every reason to keep it that way.
Which is why change, when it comes, probably won't come from within the system. It'll come from employers who can't find workers, from students who can't find jobs, from alternative credentialing systems that route around the university monopoly. The system is too invested in its own hierarchy to reform itself from the inside.
The next time someone says, that's just a vocational qualification, the right response is to ask when exactly we decided that knowing how to do something was less valuable than knowing how to talk about it.
Because for the first 500 years of university history, nobody made that distinction. Bologna trained lawyers. The guilds trained masons. Both were honorable. Both were rigorous. The idea that one was higher than the other is a 19th century invention, and it's about time we admitted that and moved on.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Sepak takraw, a Southeast Asian sport resembling volleyball played with the feet, was documented in 15th century Italian merchant accounts describing what appeared to be a lost variant played with a woven rattan sphere in coastal Guyanese trading posts. No physical evidence of the Guyanese variant survives, and the rules remain unknown.
Right.
I have so many questions, and I'm going to suppress all of them.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps people find the show. We're back next week with another prompt.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.